It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's this week's edition of Food Friday Now. When it's time for you to go grocery shopping or figure out some meals for the week, where do you go? Do you have some go-to recipes in your head? Still cooking out of a well-loved cookbook? Browsing online? There are so many ways to find and save recipes these days. Maybe you feel like you like the feel of a physical cookbook, like Paula on Facebook. Paula says, I have hundreds of cookbooks and prefer the cookbook to anything online. It's much easier to open the book than to keep unlocking a phone and see the recipe, because I never have ink in my printer. If I do look online, Pinterest and Yumly are my go-tos. Or maybe you're more like Janice, who says, although I have a full cabinet of cookbooks, searching through them is time-consuming. Online is quicker. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you go to get recipes? Do you search online, read some blogs, or do you have some favorite cookbooks to go to? Or do you check new ones out of the library all the time? Or do you have a favorite treasure trove of family recipes? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson joins me now. Judith, hi.
Hey, Rob.
Well, you are in the midst of a challenge. This is part of what inspired this this idea for Food Friday. You're doing something this year.
So I decided I'm trying a few different things, including setting a goal for visiting some restaurants that are new to me as well. That's another kind of eating. But the cooking challenge is I decided I was going to try 20 new recipes in 2020.
Wow. Nice round numbers there.
Well, I have to say, I was going to go conservative and go 12. And then my husband said, 20. So 20. and actually, I am off to a good start. I've done six so far.
Six. You're ahead of the game.
I am.
Now, before we get into some particular ideas you've tried, where are you going for inspiration?
Yeah, that's why I was really happy to join you today, because it's been a little bit of everything. I mean, I definitely do look online for some. I do like kind of plugging in, you know, if there are a couple of ingredients that I either have a taste for or have handy, you know, I'll plug those in and see kind of what pops up. I do have a not large by some standards, but I have probably a few dozen cookbooks that I find I don't go to as often as I would like to think I do. So that's another part of the project, is I'm actually going through cookbooks. And if there aren't more than like three or four recipes in there that I could actually see myself making, I'm giving them away. But I'm scanning. If there are a couple of recipes in a particular book, I'm scanning them, so I will have access to them and can search for them.
Sometimes when I have that cookbook around or I'm considering getting it, I have to tell myself, okay, this is aspirational. There's one or two recipes here that I'm going to make. Realistically, I'm going to look at the rest of them and say, yeah, no, I don't have time for that.
Exactly. And yeah, it's kind of being more realistic about what I'm really going to do, not just, oh, that looks really delicious from the gorgeous, you know, food styling picture. Am I ever going to really make it? Often the answer is no.
Well, and even if I do make it, it's not going to look like it does in the picture.
Exactly.
I am not a food stylist. Let's bring out a caller before we get back to some of your stories, Judith, at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. I'm so glad you're asking this question, because I've just been telling everybody about this. I go on, you know, I'm always on Pinterest, and I follow the New York Times food Pinterest site, and they're always posting, of course, amazing pictures of food. I want to make everything I see, and I am not a cook. I do not like to cook, but I have made very many of those recipes, and they all turn out great, and they're surprisingly not complicated. You would think from the New York Times they'd be very gourmet, and they do taste very gourmet, but they're really not that difficult.
Is there a favorite one, Laura, that you've come across?
I recently...
Oh no! We're losing Laura's line there. We'll have to be in suspense forever on that favorite recipe. But Laura, thank you so much. I worry sometimes going on random, you know, the Pinterest or just searching online or whatever, and it's some person's recipe, and it might be awesome and it might be terrible.
Right.
That's an interesting way, like go to a site like that, but follow a reliable source.
I actually just signed up for the New York Times food emails, and they link to a bunch of different recipes. And I guess what I like is that it's easily searchable. I go into my email account and search, you know, cucumber, and all these, you know, different emails will pop up, because either I've saved recipes, sent them to myself from different sites, or, you know, it came in some email.
Now, this is a bit of a digression. I saw just a news article the other day that people are putting all these food hacks online. These like, hey, you're going to save yourself effort, but they're making them up. They're terrible. And some people are testing them. And then some of these sites are now taking them off of their sites. One of them is like bleaching strawberries. Oh. Don't bleach your strawberries. That's not something you should do. So I think the lesson there is if something sounds really stupid in a recipe, don't do it.
And back
for the good stuff.
If I do search for, you know, a couple ingredients or something, I kind of look for what look like, as you said, you know, more reputable sites or sources than just, you know, some random blog.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura, at 800-642-1234. We're asking you where you go for inspiration to find new recipes. Do you have cookbooks you go back to again and again? Do you like to scout out new cookbooks? Or do you go online randomly? Or do you have favorite online sources? Or we always love to hear if you have that family treasure trove of recipes that somebody wrote or clipped or whatever from years past. Tell us about that too. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jill told us on Facebook she prefers the hard copies and she likes that she can add her comments to a book. She loves vintage cookbooks also with comments from the previous owner.
That's really cool.
I like that. And that's a great thing to hand on to somebody down the road too, I think.
So I will say that one resource that I was very pleased to use and find something great in was the Food Friday Archive.
Oh, yeah. We do that. We keep all of our old recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday.
So I went poking around in there and I found a few that I wanted to try. And one was when we had Dory Greenspan on for her book, Everyday Dory. And it was a sheet pan supper balsamic chicken with baby potatoes and mushrooms.
Ooh.
And it was really, really tasty. I will say as a caveat, you cook it at a pretty high level in the oven and it set off the smoke detector twice. So perhaps run the fan a little earlier than I did would be a good idea, or do it in weather where you can have the windows open. But it was delicious and really, really easy.
That's great. I'll say when our oven goes on, usually the fan goes on because we have kids who like frozen pizza and, well, one thing leads to another there. Give us another recipe or two that you've run across, Judith, and where you found them.
Sure. So going back to an actual, you know, hardcover in the hand cookbook, The Art of Simple Food by Alice Waters. She is known for her restaurant Chez Panisse in Oakland, or Berkeley, I believe it is. A very kind of farm to table. She was really on the front end of that, you know, seasonal local food movement. It was a mushroom ragu for putting over pasta or chicken, and it was divine. It's in our house, those kind of things get the label instant classic. And
fantastic.
This was given instant classic. Really tasty. It said it made 2 cups. I think it made 2 cups for each of 10 people. There was a whole lot of it, which I always think mushrooms kind of shrink up. But it was delicious. We had it over pasta. We had it over chicken. You could eat it anyway.
Fantastic. Let's go back to your calls now. We're asking for your favorite recipe sources, whether it's a physical book, collection of books, or online, searching randomly or a favorite site. Back to your calls now. David is with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good. What do you want to tell us about, David?
Me and my wife, we got married this fall in October, and one of our presents that we got from our wedding was my sister-in-law made a recipe book that is both our family recipes from my side of the family and from my wife's side of her family.
Oh, wow.
It's got a bunch of family pictures along with some of the actual pictures of the food it makes and then some just like pictures of people that, you know, grandmas and relatives and stuff like that.
That's great. David, is there a favorite recipe so far that you've made out of the new made family cookbook?
Some of it has definitely expanded my horizons. I don't know if I really have a favorite. There's a rice recipe that we've used a number of times. Her dad grew up in Samoa, and there's a Samoan rice recipe that I've made a lot. It's pretty simple. I like that one.
That sounds great. David, congratulations, and congratulations on getting such a great gift. What a good idea.
That's so thoughtful, and to have it from both sides of the family.
Yeah.
That's really special.
Fantastic, David. Thank you for sharing that. Do you have, Judith, a favorite family hand-me-down type recipe?
Oh, you know, my mom passed away when I was relatively young, and there are some things that she made that once in a while I'll make, but I never had a recipe for it, so they're not quite the same. But basically, you know, kind of Italian-American comfort food.
Sounds good. All right, back to your calls. Karina is with us now in South Milwaukee. Karina, hi.
Hi. I was a huge fan of America's Test Kitchen, and I know they recently changed it to Milk Street, but I love the recipes that they do and the fact that they've tested them out in their kitchens and have come up with, you know, great efficient ways for home cooks to make them. You know, we don't always have access to the type of equipment that people do in, you know, restaurants and hotels. So I think it's so great that they make them more adaptable to, you know, the everyday home cook. And I really trust what they have to say. They're great.
Karina, thank you so much for sharing that. America's Test Kitchen and Milk Street are both existing things and both provide frequent guests to our show here.
And I will say Central Time producer Bill Martin's huge fan of America's
ATK. Definitely. Test Kitchen. Thank you so much for that call. We are asking you for your favorite sources for recipes. Judith Sears Poisson is with me. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Share a favorite cookbook or a group of cookbooks, a favorite website that you go to find recipes. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday, and we want to hear from you. Where do you go for recipes? Do you like to use physical cookbooks, or do you go online? Do you have a favorite book or website? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Central Time producer Judith Sears Poisson in the studio with me. Judith, before we go back to callers, I know one of your goals, you're doing this 20 new recipes in 2020 yes. challenge. You're also focusing on some healthier cooking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all get to a point in life where you have to pay a little bit more attention to what you're eating, not just quantity, but quality and different things. And so I really enjoy the Nutrition Action newsletter. They have a lot of good health information. They also have really simple recipes that really you can see any of them and think, oh, yeah, I could make that. And one that I tried, it's a tofu peanut stew, but you could certainly do chicken with it. It was amazing and great for lunches. I also like that, too. Something you can make primarily for a dinner, but then maybe have a couple small portions left for lunches. And it had spinach. It called for crunchy peanut butter, which I did not have, but I used smooth peanut butter and then put some whole peanuts on the top. It has some tomato. It was so yummy and also really filling. And I put it over quinoa to soak up some of the sauce.
That sounds great. Let's go back to your calls now. Russ is with us in Monroe. Russ, hello.
Hi. I'm a chef owner, last 10 years, and love Food Friday. And I do have a lot of cookbooks that I use for inspiration. But having a phone and Google, you have the source of everything in the world you could ever think of. And especially one website called All Recipes I found very reliable. And I go to it often to learn the basis or the basics of certain recipes. And then I do what I want beyond that. But I find having the phone is just an amazing tool.
So you're a chef, Russ. You find inspiration from a site like All Recipes and then adapt it to make it your own at your restaurant?
Absolutely. If you're looking like for a particular recipe, maybe something Asian influenced, you can go to that and get like, okay, these are the basic ingredients. This is the flavor I'm looking for. What can I do to make it my own?
Russ, thanks a lot for the call and good to hear some Food Friday love from
thanks,
a pro.
Russ.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I do this sometimes. I've got my phone there on the counter and I'm cooking along with it. It's, you know, there's downsides there.
There are a lot of downsides. I usually have my iPad and I've got it, you know, I've got the nice thing that makes it stand up. And, you know, I feel like I have to wash my hands 42 times because it goes to sleep in between and everything. Yeah. So I have to say I like the ease of it and it's the ease of it up until I'm actually trying to cook from it.
Yeah, I do that in a pinch. One time I had what was I making? It's kind of banana bread or something, or zucchini bread, I think. And it was one that used applesauce, and I pulled the applesauce out of the fridge, and it was moldy. So I needed a recipe right quick. There I go to the phone. Usually I'll print something off online if I'm doing that. Thanks a lot for that call. Becky joins us now in Duluth. Becky, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Becky?
Well, I say that I get a lot of my recipes just from scrolling through Facebook, but one of the links that reminds me that I get a lot is from King Arthur Flour, and they offer a lot of ideas. They have a fabulous website, and the best thing about their website is when people comment on the recipes, they answer, and they also have a hotline. So if you have a question or something didn't work out, they have people that are available, home economists, that will actually troubleshoot with you.
Becky, thank you so much. King Arthur flour. Yeah, some companies that provide goods put a lot of recipes out there. I like the idea that they will interact with you.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, the turkey people do that like on Thanksgiving, but I didn't know King Arthur does that all year. So that's awesome, especially for baking, because baking can be a little touchy.
Definitely, definitely. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I love the genre of comments on recipes, though, that are like, yeah, I substituted, you know, rice in for the chicken and pepper in for the sugar, and it came out terrible. Yeah. Your recipe, 0 stars.
Yeah, yeah. Or people who haven't actually tried it and think, oh, that sounds very good.
Sounds bad. Yeah. Thanks a lot for that call. Jim joins us now in Saukville. Jim, hello.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about for your recipe sources, Jim?
In many cases, I just invent them. I look at what I have, and then I make things. So the most recent one was the other day I made something I called jambalaya.
So what was different about jambalaya, just based on what was in your fridge?
Well, my family is allergic to shellfish.
Oh, okay.
So I can't use those kinds of things. But I had half of a ring Polish sausage in my fridge, and I had some leftover brown rice.
I'm in. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So I started with bacon, 4 slices cut into a 1-inch or 1/2-inch pieces. Then I added a half a red onion. Then I added my sausage. Then I added fresh pineapple cut into small chunks.
Ooh.
Green peas. A can of chunk tomato or tomato cubes.
Uh-huh.
And then spices were real simple, just about 1/4 teaspoon of turmeric and 1/4 teaspoon of curry powder.
Fantastic. That sounds like classic jambalaya to me.
It does. It does. I've seen that version of jambalaya everywhere.
That's right.
Especially in Saukville.
But I do like, so what the key he said there, though, was like you take what you have. And I appreciate cookbooks and recipe sources. And you were talking about this earlier, that give you the technique, the basics, and then you can kind of improvise around it.
Right. And I think once you get down some of those basic techniques, then like Jim was saying, you can branch out and think, oh, well, it was good with chicken. How would it be with pork or tofu or things like that? What I'm finding as I'm going through my cookbook collection and really culling out a lot of it is I'm keeping the basics. I'm keeping Julia Child. I'm keeping Martha Stewart. I'm keeping Jacques Pepin because they tell you how to do the basics. Why are you making a face?
Oh, no. It just reminds me,
I thought it was because I was first
moving into, you know, an apartment with a kitchen in it, one of my aunts gave me your basic Betty Crocker cookbook. I still have it. I use it occasionally now, not knowing how to cook. It really laid it out. Basics, a lot of stuff to try in there. Just, that simple stuff can make a big difference. Back to your calls now. Susie is with us in Viroqua. Susie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
So I have 2 people in my family with gluten allergy and 1 with dairy allergy, so I'm not allowed to cook normal anymore. And what I've learned in that process is rather than looking for the gluten-free, dairy-free cookbooks, I look for other ways of preparing those meals. So Everyday Mexican, Beyond Curry, and Simply Nigella are 3 cookbooks that I go to frequently. And I also will use the internet. So if I want to make something that typically has some flour in it, like cornbread, I'll go and see what they have for gluten-free and try to find that recipe that has very little flour and then I can substitute. But I've found that going with normal foods and then trying to, substitute as little as possible to meet those, allergies has been successful.
Interesting. Good finds there, Susie. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Time for another caller or two, I think. Linda is with us in North Freedom. Linda, hi.
Hi.
What's your go-to source for recipes, Linda?
Well, my husband and I really enjoy it's a cookbook called The Meat Cookbook by Bruce Adell.
The Meat Cookbook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it focuses primarily on beef, pork, and lamb, and it shows you where the different cuts of meat come from, talks about the different ways to prepare the meat, and then features recipes from, you know, like ranging from Tex-Mex to Greek to Indian, and gives you ideas on how to use leftovers. And it's a really, and it also includes some side dishes in there too.
And I want to say Bruce Adell's was on the Ideas Network at some point. I can't remember if it was Central Time or if it was actually on the Larry Mueller show, but I'm pretty sure that he's actually been a guest and there would be some recipes up on our website.
Definitely. Linda, thank you so much for sharing that. I like the idea. And we've talked to a couple cookbook authors who talk about what to do with the leftover foods, too. I like that kind of really practical advice that you don't always find in a cookbook. Thanks for that call. Derek joins us now in La Crosse. Derek, hello.
Hey.
Where do you go for recipes, Derek?
Well, I go online because they have so many variations of the same recipe and you can do them in so many different ways. Like I had a enchilada that was, you didn't use the sauce, you used sour cream instead.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no sauce, it was just sour cream and all the other ingredients, you know, tortillas rolled in. But it was sour cream instead of the sauce.
Yum. Derek, thanks a lot for that. And that reminds me, Judith, like sometimes I'll do what Derek does and I'll search for blank food. But my problem is sometimes like, wait, I'm looking at 12 different recipes. They're all different and I'm overwhelmed by the bountiful choices available unto me.
Right. I think there is something to the fact that too much choice can be a little overwhelming. But when you find what I do is I email myself the recipes so that I can find them again instead of doing another search. And like you said, coming up with, you know, 14 different recipes that kind of sound like what I made. And then I can just search.
Yeah, I do. Sometimes when I print, because I worry, am I going to be able to find that link again? I will bookmark links for a recipe or I'll print it off. And I've got a folder of by now heavily stained printed off pieces of paper with recipes. But a lot of those are ones that I go back to again and again when I find a hit.
Right.
I should probably have a binder.
You should.
Or something like that.
And take beautiful styled photos of them.
Thanks to everybody for your calls. Judith, you know, you've got your 20 for 2020 challenge. You've done, you said, six. Already.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what's next? Or is there a type of recipe you're looking for next?
You know, I'm trying to actually mix it up a little bit. The most recent one I did was the spicy honey brushed chicken thighs from myrecipes.com. That was really tasty. I will keep you posted. And maybe we can talk about my next ones.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people are wondering, you're trying all these new recipes and you're not bringing them in, you know, for
a lot of
tests.
People are wondering.
There's
really
been a lot of talk.
Well,
I
will say, if anybody has a great recipe that I really should try, email centraltime@wpr.org and tell me what to try.
Yeah, I might try it too. Judith, thanks a lot. It's been fun. That's Judith Sears-Poisson, Central Time executive producer. We've been talking about different places to find recipes and cooking inspiration. Books, online, wherever. You can keep it going at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Share your favorites. Coming up after the news, a prayer vigil was held last night for victims of the Molson Coors shooting in Milwaukee. We'll talk to a pastor there about the role of faith in communities after tragedy. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest makes the case that a commonly used pesticide is a major health hazard. We'll look at some of the latest litigation. First, Milwaukee community members gathered at a prayer vigil last night to remember the people killed after a shooting by a coworker at the Molson Coors plant this week. Some 400 people attended the event at Ridge Community Church to mourn the loss of the five victims. Police are still looking at possible motives for the attack. Our next guest joins us to talk about the role the faith community can play in a grieving community. Pastor Mark Weicht is the lead pastor for the Ridge Community Church in Greenfield and Oak Creek. He led the vigil last night. Pastor Weicht, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Why did you and your parishioners want to hold this vigil last night?
Well, we, in times like this, and when horrific events hit our community, there are just certain times where we feel like we need to create a space that just allows people to come together and process, grieve, walk through this, talk about what's next, what can we do for our community as we do this. And we just felt like this was definitely one of those times.
What did you hear from people who attended the vigil?
A lot of emotions, honestly. A lot of, hey, thanks for opening it up. Thanks for allowing us to be here. Just thanks for giving us some practical things. But I think most of all, it was just, hey, we really needed the space and just being together. People stayed after, it was an hour after the vigil and people were still just together.
How do you see vigils like the one your church held last night and there are other efforts after an event like this, helping people who are in that grieving process, that sense of shock in their community?
Did you say how do I see that?
How do vigils like this affect people, you think, who are trying to deal with a situation like this?
Yeah, I think it does a couple things. I think it gives people just permission to go, hey, it's okay for how you're feeling. And so it allows that. And also, I mean, the word community is such a powerful word because that core word common is in there. And so when you gather together and other people see people around them feeling like they do, it's like, okay, this is okay for me to feel like this. This is a common emotion, so to speak. And so it just allows that. And then at the same time, at least I feel this way, I feel like we also need to give people just some, okay, here's where we go from here sort of things. So it's not just left with, okay, it's okay to feel this way. As we walk through this, what are some things that we can do to begin to walk into the pain and hurt that our community is feeling right now?
What are some of the things that you and parishioners, people who attended this, talked about looking to the future?
Yeah, there was a couple things. At the time of the vigil, there weren't a lot of funds set up, ways that you could help the families and the different people that have been impacted by the whole thing. So we didn't have a lot back then. One of the things that I touched on that I see in just when people lose loved ones and different things like that is everybody's focused on it now, and rightfully so. But one of the things I encourage people to do is I want you to put on your calendar about a week and a half from now, 2 weeks from now, when the world has kind of moved on, so to speak, but the people that have been most impacted, they haven't moved on because they can't. And so what are some things 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks out that you can do to serve, care for, give towards those that have been impacted by this? Because then that's going to be a powerful thing to go, hey, no, we're still with you. We're still walking with you, even though this is a couple weeks after.
One of your churches is in Oak Creek, which not too many years ago was the site of another mass shooting in Wisconsin. Did that, looking back on that, did your parishioners kind of have a sense of not again?
I do. I think they did. And, just like I said, so close to home. And once again, I think there was this sort of, oh, no. Are we experiencing this again sort of thing? Not necessarily in a religious institution, but still in a, I call it a staple institution of our community. And so just as impactful.
Talking to Pastor Mark Weicht, lead pastor for the Ridge Community Church in Greenfield and Oak Creek. He led a prayer vigil last night for victims of the shooting in Milwaukee at the Molson Coors facility earlier this week. Pastor Weicht, we see often after an event like this, people from different faiths coming together, interfaith groups. Is that something you've seen happening, worked on yourself?
Yeah, I love that. I love when different faith communities come together, love when different local churches come together. I always say we're better together. But unfortunately, it takes times like this to bring our community together. And that includes the different faith traditions and stuff. And yeah, I've definitely seen that through this one.
I like the idea you mentioned earlier of setting that calendar and, you know, when the initial shock is gone, going back and checking in on that event again. Do you feel like there are ways we can build that community even when we're not recovering from a tragedy? We can do more to build ourselves up together?
Yeah, that is that's a great question. One of the things that we always talk about at our church, at least, is that there's always a challenge to do that because our life is, it just feels like it's going so fast and we're so busy and different things like that. And so what we encourage people to do is set strategic times throughout the month, even if it's once a month, pick something and adopt that or adopt that organization and then, you know, serve with them once a month or a family or whatever. Just look for one thing in your life and just focus on that. You can't change everything or be involved in everything, but if you can do one a month, and then what we do is we then will take strategic times throughout the year where we'll just we'll say, hey, we're going to take these next 2 weeks and then we're going to give it 2 weeks and then we're going to take a break. And so once a month, and then look for strategic times throughout the year where you can more immerse yourself into helping those in need. Christmas time is a big one. But that's kind of how we look at it. Look for times where you can immerse yourself, but really do it one time a month, and you'll see the difference that you can make. And you'll build on that, actually. It'll become a habit in your life that will actually grow.
I've seen a lot of people who used to live in Milwaukee online. You know, there's the Milwaukee Strong hashtag. A lot of people looking back at their hometown, you know, with shock and dismay and concern. Do you have thoughts on what people, you know, even if they're not in Milwaukee anymore, ways that they can still be part of a recovery here?
Yeah, Milwaukee is such a special city. And so if you've lived here, have family here, it's such a special city. I would encourage people, don't minimize the importance of praying for the city and the community. You know, prayer does many things. I think it changes us. And we also pray for what we're focused on, so it keeps our focus there. That's another thing. Pay attention to just some of those different funds that are going to be set up for families. And if you know people here that are directly connected, and so I would get in touch with them and try to figure out a way that maybe you can join their efforts and encourage their efforts to serve our community. You know, one of the things that we're just kind of wrestling with right now is, you know, if people start going back to work on Monday there, what are some ways that our community can be there for them on Monday and really, really help the leadership there, the employees there? It's going to be a tough day for them. Tough day for them.
Yeah. Do you have thoughts for what advice would you give to someone who was going back to work after an event like this, checking back into work on Monday?
Boy, that's such a great question. Take your time. You'll never forget, but healing is possible. And that's going to take time. And it's going to be one of those, if you ever had a really deep cut or wound on your body, it can heal, but maybe it leaves a little bit of a scar. That might be that way for a little bit. And so just take your time reintegrating back into work and encourage your other coworkers and understand it's going to be hard for them as well. And so you're not alone in that process. They're in it with you, but take your time. Healing is going to come. It's just going to take some time.
Well, that makes me think, you know, we're all going to go through grief at some point in our lives, even if it's not in a, you know, a front page news event like this. Are there lessons here for people dealing with grief whenever it may come to their lives?
Yeah, when we talk about, here's the thing, we don't necessarily know how to grieve. It's not something that we automatically do. And so what grief is, it's just this, it's here's what I'm losing. Here's what I need to say goodbye to. And so when you go into a grief process with any kind of loss, we think it's the loss of a life or a loved one. But grief happens when we maybe lose a friend or something doesn't turn out the way we lose a job or whatever it may be. And so it's, here's what I'm losing. Here's what I need to say goodbye to. And now I'm saying goodbye to that. I'll tell people to take out a pad and paper and just say, hey, what are you losing? What do you need to say goodbye to? And I want you to say goodbye to, and just write that out. Write a letter to God. Write a letter. If you don't want to write a letter to God, just write a letter to yourself. But say goodbye to that and be specific about what it is, because that's really what's going to jumpstart the grief process in a healthy way. And then you may have to do that, you know, a couple times, but it really begins to identify what you're losing and then start the proper emotions.
Pastor Wyke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's an honor to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Pastor Mark Wyke is lead pastor for the Ridge Community Church in Greenfield and Oak Creek. His church led a prayer vigil for victims of the Molson Coors shooting last night. Coming up, a weed killer went from a popular product to a suspected health hazard and now the subject of lawsuits. We hear from an investigative journalist who says modern agriculture has a pesticide problem. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Superior-based boat manufacturer has landed a $56 million contract with the U.S. Navy. We'll find out about that deal and other regional stories during our Wisconsin News Roundup. Now, in 1974, the Monsanto Company, now owned by Bayer, launched a weed killer called Roundup. In the 90s, they began introducing their Roundup-ready seeds, meaning farmers could spray entire fields, officially killing weeds without, they said, harming crops. Roundup is now considered the most heavily used agricultural chemical in history. But critics have raised concerns over the health and environmental impacts of the glyphosate chemical. And thousands of cancer patients have claimed products made by Monsanto have caused their cancers. In 2018, the first cancer victim to take Monsanto to trial was awarded $289 million. Early last year, the second and third cases were brought to court, and Monsanto is required to pay out to victims again. But the U.S. EPA has ruled over the years that the chemical is safe, most recently in a report released last month. Carrie Gillum is an investigative journalist focusing on food and agriculture, former correspondent for Reuters International News Service. She's research director for the group U.S. Right to Know, a consumer group whose mission is pursuing truth and transparency in America's food system. She's the author of the book Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Carrie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot has happened in the courts in particular since your book came out, Carrie. But can you tell us, sum up for us some of the basic story, why people became concerned with Roundup and what led it into the courts?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I started covering this industry in 1998, and it really was sort of in the 90s and the 2000s that you started to see more and more research coming out from independent scientists around the world looking at the health impacts of these glyphosate-based herbicides. And they were doing this because, of course, the use was growing with genetically engineered crops. So more and more volume of this chemical was being, applied to farm fields and schools and parks and playgrounds and residential yards. So scientists started looking at this, and the body of research grew to such a level that in 2015, the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer decided to do a review of epidemiology, toxicology. There were a lot of concerns about the genotoxicity, the potential cancer-causing nature of this these herbicides. And they concluded, after they reviewed many, many years of all of these different scientific studies, that it looked like glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen with a particularly positive association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And that is what triggered all of this litigation then. All of the plaintiffs, there are more than 48,000 now in the U.S., are cancer victims or the family members of non-Hodgkin lymphoma victims who have died.
So we have that from the World Health Organization, but as I mentioned, the EPA consistently from Republican and Democratic administrations says, no, this stuff, we think it's safe. Why the difference?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of reasons to explain that. I mean, one thing is that our regulatory structure is set up to rely pretty heavily on studies that are conducted by and for the registrants. So, for instance, Monsanto, when they want to sell their chemicals, they provide a lot of the studies to the EPA. So those are not independent scientific studies. The majority of the scientific studies show a cancer connection or some other reason for concern with these chemicals. The majority of Monsanto or industry paid for studies show that they're perfectly safe. Now, even back in the 1980s, one of the very first studies that was presented to the EPA that was paid for by Monsanto and was presented to the EPA by Monsanto, the EPA scientist at that time in 1983 said, it looks like this causes cancer. The mice who are being dosed with your chemical are developing rare tumors. We think this causes cancer. Monsanto pushed back. It became a very political sort of issue. And eventually the political people overrode the scientific people in the EPA. And it was determined that it did not look like it could cause cancer. And that's been the consistent message from the EPA ever since then. But it is a very, you know, the EPA, you know, it's, as you said, Republican or Democrat, many different companies. There's a corporate capture sort of issue with our regulatory agencies. I don't think that surprises anybody. And there's a real tendency to try to be protective of corporations.
What are you seeing in other countries when it comes to how glyphosates, like Roundup, are regulated or not regulated?
Well, it is different in every country. The system is sort of the same, though, particularly in Europe, where you rely pretty heavily, the regulators rely pretty heavily on corporate-funded science. And that's not necessarily because there's a corruption issue. It's because of a lack of resources. We don't have a lot of money out there for independent, long-term scientific studies of these widely used chemicals. So you pretty much have to rely on the companies who are going to be making the money off of them to spend the money to do the research, right? But it's a very imperfect system because, as I said, reviews of this across many industries, tobacco, pharmaceutical, oil and gas, have shown that when the company's paying for the research is usually pretty favorable for the safety of the company's product. But in Europe, you do see a bit more of a protective policy, a bit more concern about public health and trying to be more protective of public health. They banned some of the chemicals in Roundup because they found them to be so toxic. Other countries have been looking to ban Roundup and other glyphosate-based herbicides, Germany, Italy, France. They are not convinced that this stuff should remain on the market.
Talking to Carrie Gillum with the U.S. Right to Know. She's an investigative journalist and author of the book Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Let's get to the current state of affairs with Roundup in the courts. We mentioned a few settlements over the years. Now, thousands more cases in the courts. But this ruling, this report from the EPA, people say this may make these court cases more difficult for the plaintiffs. What are you watching for there?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is. The EPA has really taken a remarkable move by filing an amicus brief on behalf of Monsanto, basically having their back in the litigation. The attorney general for the state of California has done the opposite and taken the plaintiff's side and saying that there is enough scientific evidence out there that you should at least be putting warning labels on these products. I mean, that's really what it's coming down to in the litigation. The plaintiffs aren't arguing that it should be banned. They're arguing that they should be warned, that because there is a body of science, even if it is still disputed, that shows that there are carcinogenicity concerns, that they should at least put a warning label on these products so that people can take that risk into consideration. But Monsanto has been pretty steadfast and Bayer, the new owner, about not wanting to put those labels on there. So, you know, that's really where it is right now. It's fascinating to watch. You don't know how it's going to turn out. We're in the appellate courts now, and we might be having oral arguments as early as April in California in the appellate court there.
And I know you're also watching another chemical, dicamba, a different weed killer. Last month, a jury in Missouri awarded a peach grower and farm owner millions, I think, in relation to that. Briefly, what is the story of dicamba?
Yeah, actually, I just collected about 1,000 internal documents today on that case. But yeah, the jury there found that BASF and Monsanto, who worked together on dicamba products, should pay $265 million to a Missouri peach farmer whose business, his farm, has essentially been put out of business because of this damage from drifting dicamba. And this is a completely different set of facts. There's not a human health concern necessarily. This is more of an environmental impact concern. And the documents that have come out through trial from these internal correspondence between the companies show that they knew and they planned for these products that they were introducing to do quite a bit of damage. And they anticipated how they were going to deal with it. And they essentially say in their documents, we know these products are going to cause damage. We're going to blame the farmers. We know there's going to be litigation, but we're going to blame the farmers and say they didn't, you know, properly steward their farms, didn't know how to grow their crops correctly and that sort of thing. So those documents really angered the jury. It seems like showing a level of deceit and deception by the corporations. There are many more than 100 farmers have filed lawsuits. Many more are expected to. So that's a whole nother liability that's facing Monsanto's new owner, Bayer.
Carrie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Carrie Gillum, an investigative journalist focusing on food and agriculture and a former correspondent for Reuters International News Service. She's research director for the group U.S. Right to Know and the author of the book Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. We looked at the progress in the courts of lawsuits over a couple of major widely used weed killers in American agriculture. By the way, the race for the White House moves to South Carolina this weekend. The results could reshape a still crowded race. We'll be following and reacting to the outcome there on the Ideas Network on Monday And you can hear live NPR coverage of the results in South Carolina's Democratic primary on Saturday. That's tomorrow, and it starts at 4 over on our other network. That's the News and Classical Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And as always, you can follow things online. Just head over to WPR.org and listen to the live stream there. Cat pictures and cat videos rule the internet, but here's one more than a century in the making. A French photographer shared this story on his blog and YouTube channel. Matthew Stern is a photographer who specializes in unique lenses and other camera technology. He found out from a family member that there was a time capsule that somebody had left in his old family home. He looked into it and found a box with some old keepsakes, a paper cutout doll, and more. Based on the objects in that box, he places the time capsule at around the year 1900, give or take. Also in the box were some glass plate photo negatives, which is a way I guess they had photo negatives back then. So what is a photographer going to do with 120-year-old photo negatives? Develop them, of course. He shares a video showing step-by-step his cyanotype process that he uses to bring the photos to life. After the first one is developed, he shows the big reveal, the final product, an image of a cat. And then photo two, another picture of the cat. And so on, more and more cat pictures. Now, it's strangely poignant to watch these images emerge of this cat taken 120 years ago. Was it a pet, a neighborhood stray that people loved? And it shows our obsession with getting cute cat pictures started way before the internet did. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.